Hello, good evening. It's wonderful to see you all here.
My name is Ellen Hickey. I'm with the Pesticide Action Network and PAN. And PAN and Food First would like to welcome you all here to what should prove to be an interesting, stimulating discussion this evening. Our co-sponsors for this evening are the University of Berkeley Institute for International Studies and California State University, Sacramento. You may have noticed, Environmental Studies Department, you may have noticed that there's papers on your seats. Those are so you can write down questions as the evening goes on, and there'll be opportunities when volunteers will pick up the questions and bring them up to the stage later in the evening. So now I'd like to introduce our moderator, Mark Hertzgard. He's an independent journalist and author whose work has been translated into 12 languages. His most recent books are The Eagle's Shadow, Why America Fascinates and Infuriates the World, and Earth Odyssey, Around the World in Search of Our Environmental Future. His work has been widely published in the national media, and he is a regular contributor to National Public Radio. May I introduce Mr. Hertzgard.
Good evening. Very nice to see you all here in this wonderful theater here in Sacramento, the Crest Theater. Can you hear me all right there in the back? How about that? You know, maybe we're going to just... All right. Is the mic on there? And that's a little bit better. Thank you. How about in the back now? Can you hear all right? All right. Very good. So thank you all for coming to this very important debate, one of the few events here at the conference that is actually open to the public. We are very... I'm very pleased to be here. I want to remind you all as we start that this evening is being taped both by radio and television for subsequent broadcast. We are not live, but it will be played later on a number of different stations, KBOO in Portland, Oregon, KPFA in Berkeley, California, and KVMR in Nevada City as well, and I believe also the local, it is. Well, hello to KVMR in Nevada City. We are with you live. And I believe as well we are joined by the local cable access television channel here in Sacramento. Welcome to you. I'll be introducing our panel here in a minute. We have an excellent panel from all sides of this very complex and important issue. I must say, as a reporter who's been covering environmental issues for many years now, this whole debate around biotechnology is one that reminds me very much of the debate around nuclear technology that happened 20 years ago, in particular here in the United States, in the sense that each of these technologies has such enormous power for good and ill, and each of these technologies, in a sense, touches the finger of God, where you are... As humans, we are getting to, in the case of the nuclear technology, learning how to split atoms, the actual energy force that puts life on this planet through keeping the sun working. And in the case of biotechnology, really changing and affecting the way that crops are grown here on Earth. So, in both of these cases, nuclear and biotechnology, the passions run very high because the stakes are so high. With that in mind, I'm going to ask everyone here to show respect, especially for those points of view that you don't necessarily think that you agree with. I must say, as a reporter, I'm always... I'm always struck by how I usually find that I learn so much more from the people that I thought I disagreed with. And I think that's a good watchword for tonight. So, with no further ado, accept one personal request, please, any of you who have cell phones. Now is the time to put them out of our misery. Please turn off your cell phones, and I will, in fact, introduce everyone at one go here, and then we will all be speaking. The evening will work like this. Each of the six panelists will have a brief presentation of approximately 7 to 8 minutes to begin. After that, there will be a short pause, and you will begin to be able to send questions forward. Look to the sides. There will be people collecting them. And then each of the panelists will have 2 additional minutes to comment on what has come before. And then at that point, we will be opening it up for questions and involve all of you in the discussion as well. So let me begin by the introductions. I don't know if this was designed like this, that the women happen to be on the left and the men on the right. But what I'm going to do, I guess, is introduce in order, coming from my left to my right. That is not exactly the speaking order, but that's the easiest way to do it. On my farthest left, Anuradha Mittal. Ms. Mittal is a native of India and the co-director of one of our sponsors tonight, the Institute for Food and Development Policy, a think tank and education for action center that is committed to establishing food as a human right and to reshaping the global food system to make it more socially just and environmentally sustainable. Next to her is Professor Martina McLaughlin. She is a professor of plant pathology at UC Davis, just down the road here. And she directs, actually, for the entire University of California system, the system-wide biotechnology research and education program for all of the University of California. Prior to taking up this position, she had been the director of the UC system-wide life sciences program and the UC Davis biotechnology program. To my immediate left, Silvia Ribeiro of ETC. Ms. Ribeiro is a researcher and program manager with ETC Group, which is an NGO based in Mexico that works on agriculture and sustainable development. She is originally from Uruguay and has a background as a publisher, journalist, and an environmental campaigner in Uruguay, Brazil, Sweden, and Mexico. How many languages do you speak? 6 languages. Let this be a lesson to us poor impoverished Americans with our single languages. To my immediate right, Mr. Amadou Kanute of Consumers International Zimbabwe. Since May of 2000, Mr. Kanute has been the regional director of a group called Consumers International, which is a global federation of approximately 250 consumer groups from 120 different countries around the world. He heads the regional office for Africa, which is based in his home country, I believe, of Zimbabwe. I'm sorry.
I'm from Senegal.
He is from Senegal. My mistake. And he was very actively involved with his various compatriots there in something called the Lusaka Declaration, issued not long ago, which called for African governments to act in accordance with the precautionary principle on the issue of genetic engineering. Second to my right is Mr. David Hegwood. He is the counsel to the Secretary of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. He was appointed counsel to the Secretary of Agriculture in June of 2001. His responsibilities there include coordinating international trade and biotechnology issues. He's also served as the Assistant Secretary for International Trade with California's Department of Food and Agriculture. He was involved in, as part of the USDA Foreign Agricultural Service, he was extensively involved in the negotiations for the Uruguay Round Agreement of Agriculture on the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, and previously worked under Senator Richard Lugar in the United States Senate. (Clears throat) And finally, to my far right there, Mr. Christian Verschoren. I'm sorry, this is a difficult name. And Dr. Verschoren has been the Director General of CropLife International, which is the plant science industry organization. And he is also a former veterinarian, I learned this evening. And he has been in his current job since June of 2000. For 6 years before that, he was the Secretary General of COMISA, the representative body for the worldwide animal health industry. And thank you all. So with no further ado, let's get started. We are going to begin with Professor McLaughlin. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I do think it's very important that we have these open forums where... Oh, can you not hear me? Sorry. Can you hear me now?
quite close up to your...
So I have to be really close.
There you go.
I've never been accused of not being heard before. I feel a little bit like Serena Williams at the French Open here. Maybe a tennis fan. But as I said, I do think it's very important that we have these open fora where people get a chance to air their views, whatever their position on agriculture technology. I come from a very small farm, a little bit east of here, and across a big piece of water. And I grew up in a semi-organic farm because we didn't have any other choice on the west coast of Ireland. It's pretty difficult to make a living there. And I figured at a very young age that surely there were mechanisms whereby we could employ whatever tools were necessary to improve agricultural productivity while optimizing the quality of life and minimizing impact on the environment. And that's why I went into scientific research. And I haven't changed my opinion about that over time. I have modified it somewhat, but not changed it. I do believe that ag biotechnology is a powerful tool that can be used as part of an integrated system, not on its own. It is not a panacea for all the world's ills. There is a lot of issues of socioeconomic nature and political nature, and among other things, in developing countries. But I do believe, as my friend Florence Wambugu had said, that the advantage of biotech for Africa, she was talking about Africa, is that it is package technology in a seed, that you don't have to teach farmers new cultural practices, which they have tried over a long time to introduce and they've never really taken. And she basically said, she was addressing Europe, she said, your issue is what are you going to have for dinner? Our issue is, are we going to have dinner? And that's why a large part of the research that I work with is to help developing countries. One specific project we have is developing better quality cowpeas. Now, the first time I talked to a general audience about this, most people thought I was talking about bovine excrement. In fact, cowpeas are a very important protein source in West Africa, in areas where people cannot afford other protein sources. But they are a very limited source of nutrition because of huge losses in post-harvest losses. Up to 40% of the harvest is lost in West Africa each year. And one particularly really bad problem is a parasitic weed called Striga that causes $7 billion worth of loss in West Africa. And in Davis and Professor John Yoder's lab, they've developed a system whereby using a genetic technology, they know what the particular signal is for these plants to act as host to the parasite. And by switching off the signal, you can basically make the plant resistant to the parasite without the use of pesticides, without the use of chemicals. And in fact, if you look as a whole to date, biotech has resulted in the reduction of 46 million pounds of pesticides in the US. That's 46 million pounds less pesticides was used in 2001 to grow crop plants. There was also a 90 to 93% reduction in fumonisin. And you might say, well, what's that? Many people think if something is natural, it's good. But believe me, some of the worst toxins in the world are produced by fungi. And the alternative to not controlling them is in Africa, for example, this leads to liquefaction of horses' brains and liver cancer. Fumonisin is not a good thing to have on your plants, and there is no natural way to control it. Likewise, for farmers who have shifted to no-till agriculture because of biotech, they've been able to reduce the amount, not just of pesticides, but actually of heavy machinery that's used, because they no longer have to till the surface, so you're not opening up the soil to erosion. You're not using heavy machinery, so you're not using fossil fuels. It's retaining water much better. You're not having runoff. In fact, they're now in the watershed regions where these crops are grown, they no longer can even trace the atrazine or any of those herbicides that have a water quality advisory. You're also finding the return of small mammals and birds. A friend of mine who's a cotton farmer in Louisiana said, for the first time since she was a child in the 50s, she has heard corncrakes back in the fields again because, as I said, they're not using chemicals or pesticides, are not plowing. They don't look as pretty. You have a lot of debris, but that is much healthier for the environment. And for farmers themselves, one farmer told me his real advantage to him is less bum time on the tractor, because he doesn't have to spend time mixing complex cocktails of herbicides. He only has to spray if and when weeds come. And in total, they saved $731 million last year. So that means a lot to farmers when they are on the edge. I also think with biotech, there is a real potential to improve food quality. And again, in Africa, this is very important, where you have huge amounts of malnourishment. And the reason I'm saying Africa is that's where I'm most familiar with, because that's where our projects are. But of course, this applies worldwide. And if you look at rice, a huge portion of the world's population is totally dependent on rice, and it's not a perfect food source. It is deficient in many micronutrients. And one I think you probably are all familiar with that has been addressed is vitamin A deficiency, work by Dr. Petraikis. And I know there's been a lot of criticism, but he's succeeded in producing beta-carotene in rice. And he's determined that the amount that you need to offset the pathologies of malnourishment is only 100 grams a day, not the 10 kilograms that I've sometimes heard used, that this is sufficient to offset pathologies, not for optimum health, but to help to reduce the 250,000 children that go blind in these countries each year because of vitamin A deficiency. There is also huge potential for using this for delivering of vaccines in these countries. Again, because you have issues of cold chain, this is keeping a vaccine cold. It's estimated that up to 50% of vaccines that are delivered in these countries are dead because the electricity went off, the power failed, and nobody knew it. But by potentially expressing vaccines in bananas, you can deliver them as a medicine. Now, these would be controlled as medicines. These would not be foods. And this is work Charles Aronson has done. To date, he's expressing cholera and hepatitis B vaccines in potato. And for clinical trials, the poor people had to munch on raw potatoes. And even the Irish don't like eating raw potatoes. But it's worked. They've got actually sterilizing protection against cholera and hepatitis B and Norwalk virus. And so this is a minor method of actually indicating that it works. Of course, the real work is getting it expressed in plants such as banana or tomato that works in these countries. Also, these crops have been more thoroughly tested than any in the history of scientific research. A huge research project was published last year out of the EU, one of the areas that's not exactly probiotech. And they have said that this was a 15-year study looking at 81 projects in 400 labs throughout all 15 countries of the European Union. And from this 15-year study, they determined that not alone are these crops as safe as conventional, but because farmers know exactly what they've done, researchers have a more better understanding of the actual research, better understanding of the traits, and because they're more thoroughly regulated than any crop plant ever, that they're probably safer than any conventional agriculture. We've been modifying crops for a long time using irradiation mutagenesis. For example, all the spaghetti you eat has been modified using cobalt-60 mutagenesis. Every Asian pear has been modified to make it resistant to black spot. And I think I'm out of time. So I would just finish with what former President Carter said. The real issue in this world is not biotechnology. The issue is starvation, and we should use whatever tool is necessary to address this. Thank you for listening.
That was Martina Newell-McLaughlin, who directs the University of California System-Wide Biotechnology Research and Education Program. You're tuned to community-supported radio, KVMR-FM.
Well, yeah, can you hear me? Is that is fine? Okay. Well, it was interesting.
Louder.
This is Sylvia Ribeiro of the ETC group from Mexico.
Okay. It was interesting to hear the vision of biotechnology. I won't speak so much about the vision of biotechnology. I will speak much more about the reality of biotechnology. And the reality of biotechnology today is that there are only five companies in the world. They are Monsanto, DuPont, Syngenta, Bayer, and Dow Chemicals that owns virtually 100% of all the transgenic seeds that are out in the fields today. There are only four crop commodities that are manipulated. It's soybeans, maize, cotton, and canola. There are only three countries, U.S., Canada, and Argentina, that account for 96% of all the transgenic crops in the world. There are only two genetically engineered traits that has been used, and they are not at all related with either vitamins or irons or something like that. It's herbicide tolerant. This is about 77% of the transgenic crops in the field, and it's insecticide plants. That's 50%. The rest is a mix of the both. But these are the only two traits that are really on the fields and are not related by any means with hunger. But there is, in this countdown, from five companies, four commodities, three countries, two traits, there is one fact that we really need to know. That is that Monsanto has 91% of all the seeds that are out, all the transgenic seeds that are out on the fields. So when we speak about agricultural biotechnology, we could really be speaking about Monsanto. It could be more or less the same. So if we see what is happening with these crops that are out in the fields today, we could take, for instance, the U.S., which is responsible for 66% of the transgenics cultivated in the world today commercially. And it's very interesting to see that the USDA made a report last year called Adoption of Bioengineered Crops. And one of the conclusions said, perhaps the biggest issue raised by these results is how to explain the rapid adoption of GE crops when farm financial impacts appear to be mixed or even negative. So transgenic crops are not doing well in the U.S. Monsanto, which is the main company, is not doing well neither. Monsanto has been showing decreases in sales for the last 3 or 4 years. Last year, 15%. And there is a Dutch consulting firm that made a study about the value of Monsanto as an investor, as to invest in. And it's very interesting because they gave Monsanto the lowest possible rating with the message that agriculture biotechnology is a high-risk industry, not worth investing in. This is for investors. But the interesting fact here is what they say. They said, money flowing from GE companies to politicians, as well as the frequency with which GE companies' employees take jobs with U.S. regulatory agencies and vice versa, creates large bias potential and reduces the ability of investors to rely on safety claims made by the U.S. government. It also helps to clarify why the U.S. government has not taken a precautionary approach to genetic engineering and continues to suppress GE labeling in the face of overwhelming public support for it. With Enron and other financial disasters, the financial community apparently bought into companies' stories without looking much below the surface. This is important to know, not because I have to confess, I'm not very, very worried for Monsanto. But why I'm taking this point is because this may explain why there is such a pressure to sell these crops that are not related to productivity. They are producing less than conventional crops in the case of soybeans, for instance. They are using more chemicals, also in the case of soybeans. And why are they speaking that they are being sold to solve hunger? We in the third world, we certainly don't want to be fed by pesticides. We prefer food in general. So what we think is that the pressure of these companies that are doing bad, plus the situation that many countries don't want to have transgenics, is obliging these companies to press upon the third world, upon people that is suffering hunger, these products. These companies are not only having a control of the market through this incredible monopoly that has not any comparison in the industrial history of the world. One company, 91% in the world. It has never happened. So besides this, Monsanto also has a world patent for soybeans. It's a species patent that Monsanto challenged when it was registered, but then bought the company that had the patent and said, it's okay with the patent now when we have it. So this is not about visions and biotechnology. This is about realities. There is another thing that is in the pipeline. It's not a market reality, but we are really afraid that it's going to become a market reality because USDA announced that it's going to be receiving applications for commercialization from this year, which is Terminator technology. Terminator technology, in addition to controlling markets, and then the rest of the world by patents, they also want to be sure that there is a biological fixes that prevent farmers from saving their own seeds. And this is Terminator technology. It's a suicide technology developed by the USDA together with a company called Delta Pipeline that was owned by Monsanto when they made the announcement on Terminator. If you ask me, well, why we insist in that this is bad, I will say one thing. 500 companies in the world, they are the largest 500 transnational companies, they give work to 1.59 of the people that works in the world, while peasants have 25% of the world population are peasants, smallholder farmers that give food to themselves and to their families, which is much more than half of the population. There is also another aspect. I want to finish quoting an indigenous leader from Mexico called Aldo González. He's from the region where they discovered that transgenic maize has contaminated local varieties, native varieties. And he says like this, he says, seeds are a central element of our lives and our culture. The pyramids might one day disappear. They could even be destroyed. But a handful of seeds of maize contain the inheritance that we leave our children and our grandchildren. Yet today, they want to deny us the ability to do that. We're speaking of 10,000 years of culture, and our seeds has proven to be safe for that many years. Today, they tell us that transgenic seeds are safe. But what proof can they offer us? 5 or 6 years of use is nothing. It does not prove they are safe. For our own seeds, we do have proof that they are safe. 10,000 years of use. Thank you.
That's Sylvia Ribeiro of the ETC Group. The ETC Group is the Action Group on Erosion Technology and Concentration based in Mexico.
We'll now hear from David Hegwood of the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Thank you. Before I came down here tonight, several people said, gee, you must do this a lot. The fact is, there aren't very many opportunities to do this. And I really want to thank the organizers for putting this forum together. I think it's obvious already tonight that this is an issue that stirs intense debate, intense emotion, and I think it's worthy of much more debate of this kind. And so I'm happy to participate in this program. And what I want to do tonight is just explain from my perspective why it's so critical to use every tool we have, including technology, to address the problem of hunger and poverty in the developing world. That's the issue that we're discussing down the street at the ministerial conference. Why do we need the technology? 800 million people in the world, that's one in every seven people, suffers from chronic hunger. Hunger hits children hardest. One in three is malnourished. And every 5 seconds, a child dies from hunger or malnutrition. The challenge of ending hunger gets bigger every day. Over the next 15 to 20 years, the world population is going to increase by over 1 billion people. The majority of that growth will occur in regions that are already food insecure. Cereal yields will have to increase by 40% just to keep pace. But yield increases in most developing regions are beginning to slow. Hunger and poverty are closely connected. Half the world's population lives on less than $2 a day. About 1 billion of the world's poorest people live in rural areas and depend on agriculture for their livelihoods. In the poorest developing countries, 90% of the food consumed is produced locally. Clearly, by increasing agricultural productivity, we can make great strides in reducing hunger and poverty. A recent study by the International Food Policy Research Institute, a publicly funded institution, suggests that an increase of just 3 to 4% in African crop and livestock productivity would triple per capita incomes and reduce the number of malnourished children in Africa by 40%. A little change can make a big difference. How can biotechnology help? It's a tool, one of many tools we need to use to increase agricultural productivity in the developing world. Biotech crops are already being grown in developing countries, sometimes with dramatic effect. 3/4 of the farmers growing biotech crops are in the developing world. In South Africa, 90% of the cotton farmers, 60% of whom are women, in the KwaZulu-Natal province are planting BT cotton. Since they started growing BT cotton, yields have increased by over 50%. Pesticide applications have been reduced from about 10 sprayings per season to 2. And these are people who spray pesticides by hand. This story of increasing yields and lower pesticide use is playing out in all of the developing countries that are using biotechnology. In the Philippines, where field trials of BT corn have just been completed, researchers experienced yield increases in the range of 40 to 50% and with lower pesticide use. Profits for farmers went up by 12 to 25%. These are real benefits for real farmers in the developing world. Is biotechnology safe? Yes. Okay, we've got one point to debate tonight anyway. 3,200 scientists, including 20 Nobel laureates, have signed a petition expressing their belief in the safety of the technology. The National Academies of Science in Brazil, China, India, Mexico, and the United States say it is safe. The Third World Academy of Sciences, the Royal Society of London, the British, French, and American Medical Associations, the World Health Organization, the Vatican, and the European Union have all said the technology can be used safely. You may laugh at the Vatican, but there are a lot of people in the developing world who listen very closely to what they say.
Please let the gentleman speak.
The vast weight of scientific evidence supports the safety of biotechnology. It is a technology that needs to be regulated. There is a consensus on that. And many developing countries need assistance in putting appropriate regulatory structures in place. We're trying to help as the U.S. government, as are many other governments around the world, as is the United Nations Environmental Program and the Global Environmental Fund. The conference being held in Sacramento this week is about finding solutions. There is no single solution to the problem of hunger and poverty. We need to look at all of the potential tools that are available. This is a global problem that deserves and needs global cooperation among scientists, governments, and civil society. No technological innovation is without risk. But there are two risks here. The first is that we do something. We use biotechnology, and it turns out wrong. So far, there's no basis for that fear. The second risk is that we do nothing. 800 million people, a billion more in 20 years, are going to face starvation. Thank you.
That's David Hegwood. He's counsel to the Secretary of the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
From, Amadou Kanute.
This is Amadou Kanute of Consumers International Zimbabwe.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Well, it happens that I come straight after my colleague on my right-hand side. And it also seems that I might have some arguments that might not totally go in the direction that has been taken by my colleague. And for that, I would like first to look at maybe the real reasons why are we being presented as the reason why we need to develop that technology. The very first reason is that the market in America is oversupplied. Production of GM crops has been multiplied in acreage, has been multiplied by 35 over the last 7 years. Second fact, consumption does not seem to follow the same trend. What we are getting is while production is on the rise, consumption is on the decrease. Most of the continents, Latin America, Europe, Asia, have shown a lot of concern about the technology. And today, about 2.5 billion inhabitants are saying we want mandatory labeling. And they're also saying if we notice that a product has the GE label, we are not ready to buy it. And that's where the problem comes from. Why should you grow things that you cannot sell? It is that contradiction that has put Africa on the map, because Africa, out of the 800 million people who are suffering from hunger, about 200 million are from Africa. So it seems that Africa is being seen as the region where we should be using the technology, promoting the technology on the grounds, on humanitarian, on moral grounds, to say that we want to save people from suffering. Now, how is this being done? That's the second question we need to look at. The development assistance that we have from the U.S. has been pushing GM crops first through food aid. And that has been done in such a way that generally most African government, most consumers in Africa were not aware. It came through the back door through food aid. That has been the first strategy. The second strategy has been to donate seed varieties, patents. We are very concerned about that, because donating patents today, donating seed varieties today, even if the multinationals and the administration is ready to forego the patents now, we don't know for how long It is just like giving drugs today. When people get used to it, in 5 years' time, you ask them to pay. The third strategy has been the use of the legal challenge against the EU on the grounds that the EU moratorium is preventing African countries to access technology. And it is taking food out of the people who are hungry. That's the third strategy. What might happen is that the US might win the case at the WTO, but we are very clear that in the end it might boomerang against the US because it is not states that dictate what is happening on the market. It is the consumers that decide what they want to buy. It is their right to choose. The fourth strategy that has been used to push the technology is what is happening here, the ministerial conference being held behind closed doors, while NGOs such as the one that we represent, who work on a day-to-day basis with the people to ensure that their food secure, are locked out. Here are the four strategies that have been used. Now, the next question is, will this technology solve the problem of hunger in Africa or anywhere? We think no. And we have some reasons for that. The very first one is to say that this technology is not demand-driven. If it were demand-driven, with 58% of the population on the globe saying, if we were to notice GM label on any product, we won't be buying it, then we won't have had these products on the market. Same thing in Africa. When the Zambian government decided that they wanted non-GM maize as food aid, the only answer we got was it's either GM maize or starvation. So, what we are saying is this is not demand-driven and we live in a free market. A free market wants supply to be to match demand, both in terms of quality, in terms of price, in terms of requirements by the consumers. If the demand does not find what it wants in a product, it's not going to take it. The second reason why we think it is not going to solve the problem of hunger in Africa is that it is not cost-effective. The Striger experience has been given. But there are alternatives to solve the problem of Striger, and they have been tested, and they are given results. But they are not being publicized. They are not getting the support that they need to be able to be used by the people who have been involved in developing it. Another example that the alternative options to the GE are not getting all the support is the rice that has been developed in West Africa, the Nerica rice, the new rices for Africa, which have been developed with involvement of farmers, of the women who toiled to harvest the rice. That rice is giving more yields, and it is from a simple technology by bringing trades from the rice in Asia, bringing trades from the rice in Africa, putting them together, and it is giving better yield, but it is not getting any publicity. It is the GM rice that is getting the publicity. Not cost-effective. The third one, is that it is not poverty-focused. We are talking here of things that only goes for 30% of the producers in Africa. While who are the people who are actually feeding us? It is the 70% of the small-scale farmers who are feeding the population in Africa. Those people don't have the resources, they don't have the technology, they are not involved in developing it, and in the end, the results are not going where it should be going in terms of income generation. So, what we intend to say is that GE is not a problem for Africa. GE is a problem for America. And America wants to turn it into a world, a program for the world.
That was Amadou Kanute, who is getting a standing ovation now. Amadou Kanute of Consumers International of Zimbabwe, getting a standing ovation here in the Crest Theater. We're broadcasting live agriculture, hunger, and biotechnology.
Remind you that we are still collecting questions along the side.
KVMR FM, Nevada City.
Thought of something else new. Please look for the people up and down the sides, and they will take your question and bring it forward, and maybe it will be chosen for discussion later.
Apropos of the ministerial meeting taking place here in Sacramento, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Mark.
Christian Verschuren, Crop Life International.
This is a difficult act to follow. I'll do my best. I want to thank the organizers, and particularly Anuradha Mittal and Food First for having invited me. I think this is actually the first time I address an audience like this, probably because it's the first time I'm invited, and so I think the credit goes to her. But it's not the first time that, you know, we have invited NGOs. We have adopted a set of, you know, values as an organization when I came on board a couple of years ago, and openness and respect are two of those values. And, you know, we try to not only preach them, but we also try to apply them at all our conferences. You know, we try to invite, you know, alternative views and, you know, preferably constructive views, but to advance the debate and certainly increase the understanding, and I view that particularly important to continue and to stress that particular part of dialogue. Another set of values that we have is sustainability. And our vision is really working together for sustainable agriculture, and therefore also, you know, through that, you know, get the idea of dialogue and working with a number of other groups, and starting from a position of respective strength of all organizations to try to design the best solution for sustainable agriculture. Now, of course, one of the other value in that, and one of the firm beliefs we have, is also technology. When we believe, I mean, a lot of people, you know, get their own views and their own definition on sustainable agriculture and sustainable development. And, you know, of course, we have developed our own, at least, you know, have views that technology has a role to play in sustainable agriculture. But when we talk about technologies, and in fact, you know, we'll probably want to broaden that term to also, you know, add the word knowledge. I mean, knowledge-based solutions. Somebody talked today about, you know, very simple sort of clay technology to deal with you know, to address aflatoxin, for example. Very simple, you know, you can probably even hardly talk about technology, but more knowledge-based solution. And I think that's very important. Also, what we like to say is that it's, you know, all the various options, technologies or agriculture systems probably are complementary to each other. And it's not a sort of either or paradigm, but rather a both or and, and seeing, you know, where, you know, the various systems and the various technologies can be, you know, adapted in the particular systems. I think Amadou said that these technologies need to be demand-driven. I think that's certainly something that's, you know, very important, and that we would stress as well, and probably more of that needs to be done. What are, you know, what are the demands? And since particularly this decennium is placed under the theme under the of development, you know, looking at the demand is particularly addressing the demands of the rural poor. And in that, in this regard, you know, what we have found, and I believe a lot of people would agree with that, is when you provide the opportunity for farmers in developing countries or in developed countries to adopt new technologies, when they see the technologies and when those technologies are adapted to their own needs, they have a tendency to embrace and adopt those technologies. And in relation to biotechnologies and biotechnology seeds, you know, since they have been introduced, I believe less than a decade ago, we've seen now 5 million farmers, mostly in developing countries, that have adopted those particular technologies. I just would like to probably point out one successful case study has been referred to a little earlier, and this were the Makatini flats in KwaZulu-Natal in South Africa. And they've been, you know, offered, there was a group of 1,400 farmers, and these are really small farmers. The average area of their farm is 1.7 hectare. You know, I hope somebody can convert that into acres. But, I mean, it's a very small farmer. 12% of these farmers adopted the technology in the first year, 60% in the second year.
And
the result
acres
has been an increase in gross margins compared to non- to farmers that were not using this technology or were using conventional cotton, an increase of 11% in the first year and 77% in the second year. And I think that is very important, is that it, you know, enabled to the farmers to have, you know, more disposable income, because it's very important to understand that we need to invert the vicious circle of low agriculture productivity and rural poverty, and to try to convert that into a virtuous circle by essentially increasing the disposable income, and that can be accomplished through increased yield, increased productivity, that will then enable the farmers to increase the quality of their produce, and also the diversification of their produce. And clearly, I think somebody said, I think Sylvia Ribeiro said earlier, it's been the first development and the first wave of this technology has been very narrow, particularly geared towards crops of the north, very specific traits, and a limited number of traits, and that is true. But I think it's important to know that also, when we talk about BT cotton, it was also some of these technologies were already adopted in developing countries. But more importantly, now we see with the development of research, and our colleague from UC Davis, I'm sure, will be able to comment that much more competently and eloquently than I would do. But there is a second wave of technological development that are coming and that are will be addressing the specific crops of develop and the specific needs of developing countries, sweet potatoes, bananas, cassava, sorghum, millet, etc. And I think it's important that, and the industry even has been involved in a number of those specific projects with a number of, local organizations in the transfer of this particular technology and in the acceptance and the adaptation of those technologies in the developing countries. And we don't hear too much about those because, of course, less than a decade is a very short period of time for an adoption of a new technology, like this. And I think that we are lacking the recul, if you like, to be able to judge that. But it's important to know that these things are there in the pipeline, that also they address not only biotic stresses like herbicide tolerance or insect traits, but they're also going to address abiotic stresses such as drought and cold and developing crops that will have a better tolerance in soil that have a high salt content. And I think it is important that to realize the potential and that these things are in the pipelines and a few years down the road before they really can be used and be used by the farmers in these countries. But I think it's important to realize that. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Christian Verschuren of CropLife International from Belgium. You're tuned to Community Sport Radio.
We're about to have our final speaker in the first round. So again,
and CropLife
was
formerly
questions,
Global Crop Protection
forward.
Federation, essentially representing the chemical industry.
Anurata Mittal of Food First.
Well, if you had the opportunity to turn on your television. If you had the opportunity to turn on the television and listen to President Bush while he was addressing the ministerial, he made the claim that biotechnology is needed to feed the third world. This is what we call poor washing, where we have seen images of third world countries being used to promote a technology that we are making very obvious that we do not want. Hunger is a very complex phenomenon in the third world countries. Let me just point out the case of my own country, India. Many of us do not realize that of those 800 million starving people in the developing world, almost 380 million live in my country. And yet it is the third largest producer of food in the world. In year 2000, while starvation deaths were being reported from around the country, Indian government had a unique problem of 80 million tons of excess food grains that were rotting in the granaries of the Food Corporation of India. Indian government was told by the World Bank and IMF to find export markets to earn foreign exchange, and it had dismantled a public distribution system. So while people were starving, the rats got into the grain, and the government thought about dumping it into the sea. And India is not unique. 78% of developing countries that report child malnutrition are food-exporting countries. So when it comes to hunger, we do not need a technological fix. What we need is something very simple, social and economic change. And if you do this again, you're going to eat into my 8 minutes, buddies. It is really going to be about living wage jobs. It is about genuine agrarian reform, which is going to ensure people's access to food-producing resources. If we want to make a dent in hunger in African nations or 36 million Americans who are starving in this country. In terms of vitamin A, rice, and in terms of these pharmaceutical crops, if we had our healthcare systems, people would not be prone to those diseases that they would have to depend on those crops. And people who have vitamin A deficiency have other deficiencies too, because they're too poor to buy an adequate meal. So if a family, a poor family, cannot afford 2 meals a day, how are they going to afford GE crops? In terms of increased yields, yes, BT cotton came to my country with a lot of fanfare last year, and earlier in the year, Science Magazine published a speculative research paper that BT cotton had increased yields by almost 80%. A couple of months ago, Indian government came out to say that BT cotton has failed in India. In fact, the Genetic Engineering Approval Committee has banned the commercialization of BT cotton in northern states because farmers in southern states are demanding compensation. Because when the normal cotton variety gave yields of 10 to 15 quintals, BT cotton only gave 2 to 4 quintals. The staple size was far smaller, and it meant a lot of financial loss to the farmers. So much for the BT yields going up. And of course, we have been told in the third world it has gone through the most rigorous testing. What we are not told is this testing is done by corporations. And it is not mandatory, it is voluntarily done. Only 1% of the USDA research budget on biotechnology goes to doing risk assessment. Our regulatory agencies have failed Americans, and they're failing the rest of the world when they lie to us that this rigorous testing has been done. And when these tactics are not working, we have seen USAID advising USDA, any third world country that rejects GM food aid, report them to us so we can take diplomatic action to ensure acceptance of shipments. We have seen bills in this Congress of United States that African nations will be told that their AIDS medications will be withheld if they refuse GM food aid. And then we see a creation of a police state in Sacramento so people can talk about feeding the third world. So people can, the U.S. administration can carry the white man's burden of feeding the third world when we are quite capable for thinking for ourselves. And that is why dissent is growing, whether it was Zambia, whether it was India, whether it was Sudan that rejected GM food aid. It is not because Europe is telling us not to take these foods. We have news for USDA. Africans, Asians, and Latin Americans can actually think for themselves. And the other news is that an agricultural system that has not worked for this country, where farmers are not even counted by census as a professional category, where we have seen erosion of topsoil and contamination of a groundwater, a model that has not worked for America will not work for my part of land. So this is a struggle for our seeds. This is a struggle for our culture and our livelihoods. And when we are told that it is going to bring benefits to farmers, farmers in the third world are very aware of those 2,000 farmers in the United States and Canada who are being sued by Monsanto. They're very aware of the fact that Monsanto is seeking royalties on GE soy that was illegally planted in Brazil. The third world can't think for itself, and it refuses to be poor washed and says no to GM foods.
That's Anuradha Mittal of Food First, who is giving a standing ovation as well. That's been our panel discussion opening up this evening, a panel discussion on agriculture, hunger, and biotechnology that is taking place at the Crest Theater in downtown Sacramento. My name is Mike Thornton. I'm joined by Alan Stoller. You're tuned to Community Supported Radio, KVMR-FM, Nevada City.
Well, Mark Hertz, quiet night here in Sacramento. So we're now going to move into the second portion of the evening where everyone has 2 minutes to comment on what they have heard so far. I would suggest that we go in the same order that we did in the first go. And everyone will have 2 minutes, and then we will get to questions. So we'll begin with Professor McLaughlin.
Well, there's too much to cover in 2 minutes, so I'll just stick to one or two points. I get to reiterate that at Davis, a large part of the focus of our research is on plants that are of zero interest to corporate America. I'll give you an example. 40% of the world's developing countries, 40% of the soil is no longer arable because of irrigation. We've developed a salt-tolerant tomato, which the technology can be transferred to cassava and other crops, that will allow them to grow in 50 times the salt concentration of water, which means many of those arable regions can now be put back into production. We can increase yield by over 300%, and there's no real way to do that using traditional systems. From a safety perspective, if you look at the farmers in China, by year three of the trials, we couldn't get enough to act as controls because they wanted the technology, because it meant over 300 less farmers died from pesticide contamination because they could use that totally organic substance DNA as a resistance system against pests, specifically against insect pests in China. Likewise, we have worked, a colleague of mine who's working on rice research, she's married to an organic farmer, and all of the royalties that she's got from developing resistance against rice blight goes back to India to set up scholarships for students back in that country itself. While I was in New Zealand, a group of individuals were hospitalized because they were eating very good, what they thought was really good quality zucchini. It looked really good and healthy. The seeds had been saved over years because they were resistant against aphids. There was a large concentration of aphids last January. The cucurbitacin level went over the top. It was highly toxic and people went to hospital. This wasn't research because it was natural. The point I'm trying to make is we have to look at the actual consideration of regulations that are going to cover all methods that we use to produce our foods, that particular processes are not the issue, it's the final product that we need to work on. And we need to use all tools in every manner that is sustainable to ensure a high-quality food supply for the world.
Well done.
Martina Newell-McLaughlin directs the University of California Biotechnology Research and Education Program.
I would just would like to emphasize that all the genetics that are on the fields, they are patented. They are the property of one of these few companies in the world. It doesn't matter if they are tolerant to herbicides or whatever. Anyone that comes is going to be the property of one company. That's what happened with all kind of research that has been done on GMOs that went out to the field. And we know that all the companies that have transgenics today, they will apply Terminator technology or any other technology that warrants that the secure dependence. Because what this technology is about is a way of taking away the seeds and the food and the disarm the food chain from the hands of farmers and local communities and give it to corporations. It doesn't matter that some research may be done in public institutions. At the end, it will end in the hand of these corporations because, for instance, they have the patents over all key pieces of research. I'm sure about the research that Dr. Martina was speaking about, because They have the key pieces that guarantees that whatever research is done in the world, it will end in their hands. And besides that, there are a lot of other problems. And we know that the farmers in the world have varieties and huge diversity and variety of solutions. As someone said here, there is not only one solution. And what we need is to have that diversity and variety of farmers. It's not surprising what was said here, that the majority of the farmers using transgenics is in the third world, is in developing countries. It's not surprising by two facts. The fact that in the U.S. they are going to eliminate farmers much faster than anything else, because you have so few farmers in the U.S. You have less farmers than prisoners in the U.S. So this is true. So we really don't need this kind of technology that is aimed to eliminate people from the countryside, eliminate diversity, eliminate the diversity of seeds and different inventives that people all over the world, over 10,000, 12,000 years, most women farmers has contributed to the world. We consider this not only a kind of pressure. We consider, for instance, the contamination of maize, the most close you can come to a genocide. And we really want to say this because this is one of the major rapes that has done to indigenous culture is contaminated maize with transgenics. We don't want that, and we don't want to have any other transgenics contaminating any local or farmers' varieties anywhere in the world. In fact, we don't want to have any transgenics at all in any part of the world.
Sylvia Ribeiro is with
Thank
the ETC group in Mexico.
Thank you. I've heard a lot tonight that I think I can agree with, a lot I don't agree with. Certainly can't go through it all in 2 minutes. But let me try to get through a couple of points. One inconsistency I just heard was one of our speakers said that overproduction of agricultural crops in the United States is driving third world farmers out of existence, and then I just heard that U.S. farmers are going out of existence. So I'm not quite sure where the problem is there.
Please let him speak. You are all here to hear the people up here. Let them talk.
One thing I do agree with, I heard, is we need to develop local solutions, and that's happening. I don't think we need to put up false choices. We don't need to make a false choice between a conventionally produced rice variety and a transgenic rice variety. They may have different uses in different regions, but you know, let's base the decision on science. Why don't we look at the science? Let's evaluate whether the transgenic rice has some potential to help farmers in these countries. If there are conventional varieties that are better, let's use those varieties. But you know, we need to make these decisions on the basis of science, not on the basis of emotion and rhetoric. And that's what we're asking for. Let's talk about money. Let's talk about the farmers in South Africa and the farmers in the Philippines who are making more money because they're growing crops that they don't need as many pesticides for. Let's talk about the farmers in those countries who don't have to walk out into the fields barefoot to spray pesticides by hand. Part of this forum is sponsored by the Pesticide Action Network. We've demonstrated real reductions in pesticide use in developing countries, and yet some people want to deny the farmers who get the greatest benefit out of this reduction in pesticide use the technology that allows them to do it. How does that make sense? We do need to have debates over this. One more.
Please, come on.
I am here. That's why I'm here.
There are people up on the panel who will answer all of these questions. Please let us talk.
I've heard that farmers can't afford GE crops. Well, as I think I've shown you, there are farmers in the developing world who are growing these GE crops. 90% of the food consumed in the poorest parts of the world is produced locally. Now, to say that these farmers can't afford GE crops is a non sequitur. What they need is to grow their own food. And if this technology can help them do it better, then why do you want to deny it to them? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
David Hegwood is the counsel to U.S. Secretary of Agriculture, Ann Veneman. Amadou Kanute of Consumers International Zimbabwe.
The very last reading I did before I came to this meeting has been some sort of a double eye-opener for me. And I would like just to take my 2 minutes to read you, to go through this text, and maybe what I will be reading will be answering some of the issues that have been raised. The very first, well, I'm reading from a document done by Aaron DeGrassi, and he is from the Institute of Development Studies, University of Sussex, Brighton. He is saying, looking at what has been used to showcase how successful the small-scale producers in South Africa have been by adopting GE technology in cotton or sweet potatoes in Kenya. Here is what it is saying. He's saying that the amount of labor saved is unclear. In fact, farmers spend more money on the engineered seeds, which are twice as expensive as conventional ones, than they save on reducing pesticides. Then it goes on saying, and there I will really need to be educated. It goes on saying that about how much profit the small-scale producers are making, we've got such an array of figures that I am at a loss. It is saying crop gene says farmers gain 113 per hectare. Monsanto says farmers gain an extra $90. ISAAA argues that switching to BT allows farmers make an extra $50 per hectare. University researchers calculate $35 per hectare, while the survey team found farmers gained only $18 in the second year. But in the first year, BT cotton non-adopters were actually $1 per hectare better off. Which figure should I go for? Then the last point I would like to make, and which is also very important, it is why are we insisting so much on the alternatives that are more, that are appropriate in terms of technology, in terms of level of development, in terms of know-how, in terms of just making the farmers control what they want to produce, how they want to produce it, and just to master their own future. It is saying here, with regard to the cost effectiveness of developing the modified sweet potatoes, maximum gains in yield increase from resistance are estimated on the basis of interviews largely with project staff to be 18%. This is sweet potatoes in Eastern Africa, Kenya. The sweet potato project is now nearing its 12th year and involves over 19 scientists, among which 16 are PhDs, and an estimated cost of $6 million. In contrast, conventional sweet potatoes breeding in Uganda was able in just a few years to develop with a small budget a well-liked virus-resistant variety with yield gains of nearly 100%.
Thank you very much.
Amadou Kanute of Consumers International in Zimbabwe.
Thank you. One point I wanted to build upon is the issue of sort of corporate control and sort of image that has been painted of you know companies sort of controlling the food chain. I think it's, and talk about reality, I think I'd like to bring a, probably a little bit of a reality check here. I think it's very important to realize here that when what we're talking about here is first of all is the seed industry. We're not talking about the food chain. We're talking about the seed industry. It's quite important to realize that the percentage of biotechnology seed compared to conventional seed is very, very small. Second is that in a country like India, India has been mentioned, for example, there are still about 200 seed companies, and there is a number of very important state-owned companies, and therefore a lot of seed production still is in the public sector. The other point is also, and so I think it's important to realize that, you know, owning a patent is different from owning a seed. And that a patent has been essentially designed for two things. One is to promote innovation, and the second thing is to, ensure that the knowledge from that innovation is being disclosed, I think, to essential public goods, and that in return for that, you know, for those two things, the inventor does indeed enjoy the monopoly for the commercialization of that of his invention for a limited period of time, and therefore after that limited period of time. So I think it's very important to, you know, realize that when some people sort of painted a sort of very doomed scenario that we'll, you know, what we eat will all be controlled by a handful or even only one company. And so I think that's important. The second probably point I wanted to mention, and you know, I guess probably in defense of my colleague on my left here, is about a regulatory assessment. It's been said that the trials are being conducted by companies, and yes, that is true. But that's how the regulatory system is being designed, is that but it's been designed like that for a number of technologies, for pharmaceuticals, for example, as well. Now, and so, you know, you may disagree with that, and there may be other ways to that, and that the development of the technology is entirely in the hands of the government. And I think that system has been tried, you know, before as well, with the results that that we know. There are a number of controls in the development of those products, and thereafter there is a thorough assessment, you know, by the regulatory authorities. So, I mean, painting the view that because the trials are being carried out by the developing company, that as a result of that, you know, the results are not credible or biased is something that has to be corrected. There are a number of control processes in the development of those particular technology, and there is a fully fledged assessment in this particular country by three agencies to assess the safety and the efficacy of the technology. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And finally, that was Christian Vershoen of CropLife International. This is Anuradha Mittal of Food
First.
Well, I think
in terms of leaving it up to science to decide for us if we should be using this technology and the system that has been explained to us in terms of regulatory agencies, it's like giving a key to the bank robber and asking the bank robber to guard it for us. So the other way the science is working in this country is by saying we don't need to label these foods because they're just like the, you know, any other food, the food that you've had before, and then run to the patent office to saying it's really different, we need a patent on it. So I would just say that more than science, I think what we really need is to respect the sovereign right of farmers. For example, farmers in the Philippines have been mentioned who've been on a hunger strike demanding the complete moratorium on commercial planting and of GE crops. So if we actually listen to the farmers' movements, I think we would know what the farmers really want, since they have been the keepers of our seeds and taken care of the best stewards of the land. Also, give the right to the third world countries to have their own process. We saw in the case of Sri Lanka when it tried to put a ban on imports of GE crops, a lot of pressure coming from the WTO to USAID. We have seen the same kind of pressure on Zambia and other African nations and all kind of arm-twisting tactics. Let the third world alone and let them go through their own regulatory process, because we have seen that process fail in the United States with the Starlink corn, when corn not meant for human consumption got into a food system, leading to a recall of more than 300 corn-based products. Last December, we saw corn genetically engineered to stop dairy and piglets get mixed in a food system. So we know the regulatory agencies have failed in the United States, and we want to be able to work with our own regulatory agencies and come up with our own process.
That was Anuradha Mittal of Food First. And you are tuned to a special presentation, a live debate on agriculture, hunger, and biotechnology.
With this timid audience, I don't know quite how we're going to have anyone come forward. I'm going to call out the names of a couple of people and ask you to make your way to the microphone. In the meantime, I'm going to ask one question. Some of the questions that have come up have been repetitive, and so I'll phrase a couple of those here.
This is Mark Hertzgard, who's moderating tonight's event from the Crest. You're tuned to community-supported radio KVMR-FM.
To make your way to one of the microphones, I believe the microphones are, where are they? They've been taken back. So that means what then? That we're going to...
You read them.
I'll read them out then. That's probably the easiest.
I see a bit here, and it's frustrating. It's always happened, even in the introduction mentioned that this does happen. If people are talking past each other on the panel, they're not addressing each other's concerns so much as talking past each other. And I don't know how we're going to get around this.
I hope perhaps the questions will take care of that.
Can go to all sides of this, and it gets to it's about labeling. This is one of the big complaints now, one of the big divisions. A number of people say, why not just label the foods? If the foods are so good, why not let them label? In fact, one questioner says, why doesn't industry get behind labeling as a marketing tool to let people do that? And as some background on this, it's important to know that at least in the past, a number of countries, especially in Europe, have required labeling. The United States government's official position, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, and the industry's position has been to be against labeling. So if I could begin with that, and let me ask perhaps Dr. Verschoren to begin. Why wouldn't the industry favor labeling?
I think, first of all, the question is fairly complex when you look at it on a global basis. What is first of all, if the question you will have to ask is essentially to the food industry, because I think what you're asking here is the technology industry, whether it is in favor or not in favor of labeling, whilst in fact that question needs to be addressed to the food industry. And you get very different answer depending on which region you find yourself into. In generally, what we have said is that labeling must have a purpose, and in the sense of addressing a question in terms of providing information to the consumer, in the sense of whether there are some health consequences, where there is substantial difference, there is a reason for the agency providing a mandatory labeling. For the other cases, essentially what we're saying is we need to leave the food chain, the actors in the food chain, to decide what is most appropriate in relation to labeling.
Let me follow up here with Amadou. As someone who has been skeptical of biotechnology, would you accept biotechnology if it were labeled?
Other factors are really important to take into account, particularly when it comes to right. Why are we asking for labeling? First, to exercise the right to choice. That is one. Why are people after choice in this particular case? It's because the models of production behind GE are seen by people has not been sustainable. So the labeling here, and that's precisely why industry is not very open to getting labels on the product. It is precisely because people are very concerned about what impact it is going to have on their environment. People are concerned about health aspect. People are concerned about sustainability, being able to produce food after the GE technology has been introduced in the environment. So all those aspects are really the real reason why industry seems to be saying no. We are saying, if your product is a novel product, if your product is something that you think is bringing a plus to consumers, then go ahead and label it. When you label it, then people can make a choice depending on other aspects that they think are important. So these two things should actually go together. Once you label, then you are able to decide whether you want to go for it or not.
Thank you very much. We'll go to Marmota Pellegrosso's question here, and there's a second one from another person that raises the precautionary principle. Is the basic scientific precautionary principle taken into consideration when you decide to push ahead with the development and marketing of GE seeds? A. B. Who will be held responsible for any possible damage caused by these products? And finally, from another person, if we discover later that GE food is dangerous after it has been introduced into the environment, how will we recall it? Professor McLaughlin, could you take a stab at that, please?
Sure. Actually, this leads back to the issue of labeling, because, in fact, labeling is required. If there is an issue of potential increased toxicity, modification of nutrients, in potential allergenicity, or change in complexity of the food itself. And I'll give you an example from Davis with respect to substantial equivalence and precautionary principle. I'm not sure if we have any tomato farmers here, but for processing tomatoes, high soluble solids are a big requirement. And we took two approaches to producing this in Davis. One, using a traditional method where we crossed it with a wild variety of tomato that has high soluble solids. It has a lot of things that you don't want: small size, poor taste, bad flavor, and it's toxic. And it took us 18, 19 years of backcrossing to get rid of the components that actually express the toxic genes. Now, using biotech, we achieved the same thing. We didn't introduce any foreign genes. We turned off a gene that switches from what's called a xylose producer to a sucrose producer. The interesting thing is the product that's out there is the one that was crossed with the toxic genes, and this was done using a traditional system. The biotech one is regulated up the wazoo and is going through the process of deregulation at this point in time. The point I'm trying to make there is the one that was produced traditionally, because it was done through conventional breeding, it wasn't taken into consideration that it was crossed with a toxic gene, with a plant that produced that had genes for high glycoalkaloids. So the notion is that you need to look at the product itself, with respect to safety and potential negative environmental impact. That's the component that you need to look at. The example I gave earlier of zucchini, again, looked perfectly healthy, looked really good. In fact, it was big and green. But the reason it was big and green, it was producing its own pesticide, again, a glycoalkaloid cucurbitacin. And because it wasn't sprayed, it was helping itself to keep the insects off. So with any system, because plants are not benign, they can't run away. They produce an awful lot of nasty things. About 90% actually of carcinogens come from plants. So we have to look at the system that is most appropriate to ensure the safety and efficacy of the product itself and the environment.
Thank you very much. I'm told now that we do have some microphones in the audience, so I'm going to invite up a couple of people to do that, and in the meantime, I'll pose one, while they're making their way to the mics, I'll pose one more question that's been put by a number of people. Oh, I'm sorry. Please. I hear you. You must think that we're deaf up here. I don't know. There were some other questions about the precautionary principle, and I sensed that Anuradha wanted to step in, so why don't you take a shot at those? In the meantime, may I ask, please, that Mr. George Naylor and Ms. Caroline Lucas find your way to the
microphone. Anuradha Mittal of Food First will be speaking next.
I would just answer in terms of who is responsible. The insurance industry is not providing insurance to the corporations for putting the products out there, and the farmers are the ones who are signing contracts. Basically, if anything goes wrong, it'll be the farmers who will be responsible, not the insurance industry, not the corporations, but our farmers.
And the question of recalling is brought up. How do we recall it if it turns out that we made a mistake?
Again, getting back to the point I made, the system that you use, you look at the cost to benefits at the particular point in time. With these crops, they have been more thoroughly studied than any in the history of scientific research. There was a discussion about maize earlier. Maize is highly unstable. 50% of the maize genome is made up of jumping genes, as determined by Barbara McClintock back in the 1940s. And in fact, that's where you get all the interesting kernels. The point I'm trying to make here is that you're working with a system, using traditional systems, or using mutation. I talked about the fact that all of our spaghetti is produced using radiation mutagenesis with cobalt-60 to modify the paste consideration for semolina production. All of the Asian pears out there that are resistant against black spot disease were produced, again, using mutagenesis. So there's all these systems out there with imprecise methods and imprecise technologies, but nobody ever looked at them before. And when you look at these, they look over time, where specific considerations such as the issues with potatoes or tomatoes where you have glycoalkylates, or zucchinis with glycoalkylates, you look at those issues. You make the best possible decision at that point in time. I'll give myself an example. I have an autoimmune disease. I take a biotechnology product that's keeping me alive. I'm not sure if it may kill me eventually, but it went through huge, exhaustive tests by the company. It was regulated, but by the company itself. It was patented so that I could actually get it. But the point I'm trying to make is you look at the decision you have at any point in time. You look at the risks, you look at the benefits, and you make decisions based on that.
Okay.
So do you
we have your questions
That's
here.
Martina
Please don't
McLaughlin
shout.
Of
Please
the
don't shout.
Of California Davis.
You can all decide whether she's answered.
You're tuned
all
to community
ups.
Supported radio KVMR FM, a special live
Caroline Lucas, are you at
Crest
the
Theater.
Microphone? Yes. Why don't you speak up?
Is it on? Okay. My name's Caroline Lucas. I'm a member of the European Parliament for the Greens, and we're doing our best to keep GM out of Europe at the moment. But I had two questions for David Hegwood. The first is that he's talked a lot about how concerned the US government is about poverty in developing countries. And so my first question is, would he not agree that changing the rules of the World Trade Organization, which actually have a much greater impact on reducing poverty and reducing hunger in developing countries than investing in biotech, because the rules of the World Trade Organization, the rules of the WTO agreement on agriculture, are fundamentally about breaking down the barriers in developing countries and forcing through our exports into those markets and undermining the markets of those people there. And my second question is, if biotech is as safe as you say it is, why are the GM companies doing all they can and lobbying me and my compatriots in the European Parliament as much as they can to avoid legislation on liability?
Well, first to the question about WTO rules. I'm not sure what rules you would suggest that we change. In fact, most developing countries did very little to open up their markets to imports as a result of the Uruguay round. Most of them were exempt from substantial reductions in their tariff commitments. So there hasn't been a tremendous influx of imports from the developed world to the developing countries as a result of the WTO rules. So I would suggest that, you know, if you're really interested in that subject, that you look at the data and see if there really is a problem there. In fact, what developing countries need is economic growth, and one facet of economic growth comes through export earnings. These countries need markets for the products that they produce in order to earn income. I'm not going to solve all the world's problems tonight, okay? So we can't, you can't isolate a country from the global economy and then expect it to grow. It doesn't work that way. So, if you want to have a specific discussion about how WTO rules are going to impact developing countries, that's what we're doing in Geneva with the Doha Development Agenda, which is focused on how we find solutions to help developing countries participate in the global economy, not be excluded from the global economy. And the second question was liability. I don't know why the companies are lobbying you about liability rules. What I do know is that the United States, the European Union, and most other developed economies have legal systems that already accommodate some notion of liability. It may not be to everybody's satisfaction, but it's a very complex subject, and I suspect that in starting to talk about how you would change liability rules to deal with risks that are not even foreseeable, risks that may not even exist, because we're talking about a precautionary principle that takes as its premise that something in the future could go wrong, and we don't need any proof right now that that may happen, so we can impose liability on somebody just, you know, in case that fate works out that way. You have to have a better basis for liability than that. It's a very complex legal issue, and I think it's, you know, it's something that probably does need to be debated, but it needs to be debated in those terms.
Is George Naylor at the mic?
Yes, George Naylor, a farmer.
Yeah. Hi. I'll try to present a less complex legal issue for you. I'm a corn and soybean farmer in Iowa, and I try to raise non-GMO crops for sale. And my neighbors, of course, occasionally raise GMO corn. And when they buy Monsanto's varieties, they get what's called a technology user guide. And in that guide, it says, well, yeah, it's just nearly impossible to prevent GMO pollen from drifting and contaminating other crops. Therefore, my neighbors are supposed to inform me that I'm supposed to have a buffer. Okay? Now, so far, none of my neighbors have voluntarily told me that they are raising GMO crops. I usually have to go ask them if they are and where they're located. Now, could you explain to me why? Well, and another point is that I was just in Vermont this last winter visiting farmers, and I met many organic farmers whose farms were so small that if their neighbor raised GMO corn, they would not be able to raise organic corn on their farms. Now, could you explain the legal intricacies of why I am supposed to provide the buffer and why Monsanto is not responsible for contaminating my crop?
You're tuned to a live debate from the Press Theater on biotechnology, hunger, and agriculture. You're tuned to KVMR-FM.
This is why the government pays you those big bucks, David.
The short answer is no, I can't answer that question. I don't have an answer for that question. It's an issue that is becoming of increasing importance at the department. It's not one that I have been personally involved in to date. But it is one that I can promise you that we will look into. I will take it back. And we'll look at it.
Is there anyone else here on the panel who could speak to that? Why is it that farmers have to carry the risk?
Actually, one of the best ways to control it is Terminator technology. Because with hybrid corn, it's going to stop the gene flow. The next generation of plants are actually being produced using what's called chloroplast transformation. So the chloroplast is sort of the ultimate feminist organelle. It goes through the mother, it goes down the mother line, it doesn't get into the pollen. So the actual genes will be retained within the mother plant. It isn't absolutely perfect. You may sometimes get some backcrossing to the genome, but it is like 99% perfect. But male sterility, corn male sterility, is one of the best possible ways to control this. And the decision to not allow GM was the organic farmer's decision, and I don't understand why. My friend from who's married to an organic farmer, her husband, who's an organic farmer, says he doesn't understand that decision either. But the decision, as I said, was by the organic farmers to decide that GM wasn't organic, and I don't understand why myself as to why that decision was made.
Sylvia Ribeiro will speak to a second, but first may I ask Monica Moore and Andrew Geller to come to the microphones.
That was Martina McLaughlin of UC Davis.
I am kind of sensitive on Terminator because before
Ribeiro.
We were called Cedera Group, we are Rafi, and we discovered a patent on Terminator. And we have been following the development on this. And Terminator is a technology for making suicide seeds. And what Martina is suggesting here is that because they have a bad technology that they don't know how to, they will contain, how they will put an even worse technology that we will suffer for all of us. So all the crops will have both the one technology but also the other ones, and then you will have a change of different genes that can get separated from each other, in fact, and produce they don't know what. But because Terminator is not so very good neither, they will add something else that we take that will take both Terminator and the other, which is called The Exorcist now, we have called it so, which is another... This is true. So what is incredible is that for the profit of really, really very few corporations, we all have to suffer and being subject to be guinea pigs of these kind of experiments, and also accept that Terminator is good for biosafety to the cost of food sovereignty, of food security for all of us. That's completely unacceptable.
That was Sylvia Ribeiro of ETC.
Monica Moore at the microphone.
Yes.
Please go ahead.
Monica Moore with Pesticide Action Network, North America, and also Pan International. My question is for Dr. Christian. Many panelists have mentioned, and we hear frequently, that one of the justifications for this is that it will reduce the use of pesticides. And in fact, pesticide poisoning is a major, major public health threat throughout the world, this country included, but certainly in the developing world. So my question is, quite apart from genetic engineering technologies, would CropLife International be willing to commit tonight to say that their member companies should no longer produce Class 1A, 1B, and Class 2 pesticides, which are responsible for the vast majority of poisonings throughout the world? Simply stop producing, selling, and pulling them back, which would do more to end and to certainly to reduce the pesticide poisoning that has been mentioned as a justification here.
Thank you for that question. I think it's the issue of pesticides poisoning is one that is a lot of concern to us and one that we have been trying to address for a number of years, and I'll come to that in a moment. First of all, it's important to realize the complexity of that issue, particularly in developing countries. All complex solution, there's usually one very simple and wrong solution. So if you allow me to explain a little bit and elaborate a little bit on the complexity of that particular issue. But if you want to have a short answer, is that there's answers there is in two forms. One is strengthening regulatory regimes into developing countries, and this is something that CropLife International, through our network of association, have been collaborated with FAO and with the local government in putting in place solid regulatory frameworks. The second answer to that is proper stewardship. And you probably know, and I'm sure your organization is aware, that since 1991 now, when the organization was called GCPF, we have initiated safe use programs all around the world, starting with pilot programs in Thailand, Guatemala, and Kenya, and expanding these programs into the rest of developing countries. This being said, we need to do more, and we actually have engaged with the dialogue and would like to have more of a dialogue with the Pesticide Action Network and other organizations to try to see what other measures we can take. In terms of the... Thank you. At least I can go home and say it was a successful night. But we will look into that, that particular matter, and invite the Pesticide Action Network and Barbara Dinham in particular to discuss that. Thank you.
Christian Verschuren,
is Andrew Geller,
CropLife International,
KVMR FM, Nevada City.
This is for you too. and I'll shorten the question that was up there. Given the issue of genetic drift that George Naylor brought up, and independent non-governmental organization studies and research about increased use of pesticides, Percy Smizer here could talk about that in Saskatchewan with canola, and lower, not higher, yields of transgenic crops. Can you still stand behind your statement in your first segment that there is no cause for concern about biotech agricultural crops?
Yes.
Trying to remember your question exactly. Okay. The question of genetic of pollen drift. Two parts to that. One, is there an environmental risk? Is there a health and safety risk? That we can address and do address through the regulatory system. We can, you know, once we have determined that the product is safe, that it creates no environmental risk, that it creates no health and safety risk, then the pollen drift no longer becomes a health and safety concern. All right. Now, the next part of that is there some other reason to be concerned about pollen drift? Mr. Naylor's concern was that it impacted his organic production. All right. Well, that's not a health and safety issue. That's not an environmental issue. That's a marketing issue. That's a question of whether this farmer is going to realize the full value of his crop. It's not a question of whether his crop is any less safe. It's a question of whether he gets the premium for growing an organic crop. So do I stand by my statement that it's safe? Yes, I stand by my statement that if it's been through our regulatory system, that it's safe.
About whether or not you thought it was safe, it was whether or not you thought there was any cause for concern.
Well, I'm
quoting you earlier.
Did I say actually no
yes.
cause for concern?
Yes, I'm a journalist. I get quotes very.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I certainly believe you. In that case, let me say that the context for saying no cause for concern was the health and safety and environmental risk context, not the commercial context. Is there a commercial issue? Yes, obviously there's a commercial issue there.
Okay, let me ask Steve Wirtz, please, to come to the
That was David Hegwood of the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
And right.
You're tuned to Community Support Radio, KVMR, FM, Nevada City.
Speaking as another journalist, to the critics of genetically modified foods. I was listening today to the forum program on KQED, and Peter Pringle, British journalist, has a book out now called Food Incorporated, in which he has looked at the entire industry of GE food and at the critics. And Anuradha Mittal was on that program as well. And Mr. Pringle made a point, I believe, that there's a lot of possible benefits to come out of genetically modified food, as well as a lot of problems. And in his view, the difficulty was, is there a way that the technology could be properly regulated by government agencies? So let me put the question to the three critics here. Would you completely rule out the possibility of genetically modified crops ever playing a role in agriculture and therefore hunger issues around the world if you yourselves could be the ones designing the regulatory process and overseeing the regulatory process? Would you shut the door entirely in a sort of a Luddite position, or do you believe that the problem is one that could be fixed with intelligent and empathetic regulation? Anuradha Mittal.
Well, I think the rationale that's been presented to us that we need this technology to feed the third world, we would need, first of all, a real reason as to why we need this technology, because We do not need this technology to feed the third world. Second would be we would need to follow precautionary principle, and we would need to have real evidence that it is really safe. And the problem, as we have seen with the revolving door policy, we have seen our regulatory agencies not doing their jobs. That evidence is not about to come in because we are being told right now that it is safe, that there is no need for concern around environment and around health concerns. So given that factor, that we do not have precautionary principle, it will not be acceptable. Thirdly, till we can ensure that people have, that we go through a real public debate and discussion is allowed, that if we really want this technology, we do live in democracies. We cannot allow a handful of people to make those decisions for us. Even in this country, this food got into our market shelves without a public debate. So we would need a public debate, and if the people really want this technology, and I think if a decent rationale is indeed presented, you know, we would see where it goes with that. So till that happens, we're not about to budge on it. At least I'm not.
Mm-hmm. And Sylvia Ribeiro, you are the regulator. You are the regulator. You get to run it. Would you allow it?
Well, I wouldn't like to be a regulator for anyone in the sense that I think that one of the main thing that has been that has been alienated from all of us is the real control of our lives in almost anything and almost all aspects. And I couldn't be a regulator for any other people rather than try to recuperate the real empowerment of local communities to decide which kind of food, which kind of agriculture, which kind of industries they would like to have. Having said that, I have to say that genetic engineering in particular, I think is a technology that is so uncertain, that there are so many things that are unknown, the consequences about genetic engineering, that I think preliminary that this is a technology that should completely disappear. That's my view on the issue. This is because it's a technology which is completely artificial, that is crossing realms that could never have been crossed, and that would never cross in reality, that is completely unaware of the long-term effects and also the effects on not only the biodiversity in the environment, but also the diversity within the genome and the interactions in the genomes and the genomes with others. So I think this is a technology that should be banned.
And Amadou Kanute, same question.
The African countries have come up with a model law on biotechnology. And that model law, as it stands now, has all the provisions that would allow what the farmer was talking about, which is, in case of liability, allowing the one whose products have contaminated the other one to pay for that. The same model law also has the possibility for us, when we are not happy with something, to have a class action. The same model law says that both for import and export, there should be prior consent of the recipient country of the type of food that is coming in or that is being exported. That model law also provides for mandatory labeling. So here are some specific aspects that we have been asking for, which unfortunately are being undermined by the pro-GM lobby. They are now coming up and saying, we need to develop an alternative to the African model law. While it is this law, this model, that we think really takes into account all the concerns that are being raised both by the farmers, consumers, governments, small-scale farmers, and so on. So what we are saying here is we are in a market, and market, when there are deficiencies, when they are not effective, you need to come up with regulations.
And this mother law, which is now being undermined, is the one that we would like to see being enacted instead of it being undermined by the pro-GM lobby.
Thank you very much. Peter?
It's Amadou Kanute of Consumers International in Zimbabwe.
We're going to have a couple more questions, but first an announcement.
You're tuned to Community Supportive Radio, KVMR-FM, Nevada City. This is Peter Rossett of Food First.
Good evening. My name is Peter Rossett from Food First, the Institute for Food and Development Policy. I would like to say how appreciative we are of the Crest Theater and the Crest Theater management and Sid, who is here tonight, that they have been willing to take what is a considerable risk for them in allowing this event to take place, given the circumstances in Sacramento, and I'd like to have a big hand for the Crest Theater and their manager. The co-hosts this evening are Food First and the Pesticide Action Network. And we want to thank all of you and especially all of our speakers for coming to our house tonight because, in a sense, the Crest Theater tonight is our house. So thank you. And this is a difficult issue to raise, but we're going to have to ask on behalf of Food First and the Pesticide Action Network and Crest in terms of our house for a particular kind of respect this evening, which is, number one, to pick up any trash that's on the ground when you go up and go out and put it in the proper receptacle, but more so because the Crest Theater has basically, in taking the risk of having a controversial event, essentially staked their reputation on this being a peaceful event. And I know everybody here came tonight for a peaceful dialogue, to hear all of the different points of view, and to be able to make our own informed decisions. When we go out of the theater, you will notice some police presence outside. But this is a serious issue, because it's our house, and we've taken responsibility for our house, which includes our front porch. The police presence has fluctuated up and down. It's not as strong now as it was before, and the Crest Theater, together with us, have been negotiating a bit with the police for the possibility of a very peaceful and respectful departure from the theater. We really owe a big debt of gratitude to the Crest Theater, and I would really ask everybody, if possible, to agree to the essentially what we have agreed to with the folks who are outside, the law enforcement officials, which is that they would like people to not hang around in front of the theater when we go out, and we would also like people not to hang around because it's a commitment we've made to the theater, but rather to very peacefully and calmly disperse on to whatever your next destination may be. Now, we're on K Street, and the principal concern, apparently, that the police have is that we not hang around on K Street very long. They would just like us to go to either one of the corners, half a block in either direction, and disperse to wherever we're going along the side streets. And we have said that we would ask you, as a measure of respect to the Crest Theater and to this being our house tonight and to this being a peaceful dialogue, a kind of dialogue actually we would like to see take place much more. Probably there wouldn't be a need for protests if it did. A kind of dialogue we would actually like to have seen take place inside the convention center with the ministers in the audience. But as a measure then of respect for Food First and PAN, and especially for the Crest Theater, we do ask that folks very quietly and calmly exit from this particular block and go off on the side streets, and we wish everybody a wonderful evening afterwards, wherever you choose your final destination or next destination to be. So thanks. Thank you to our guests. Thank you to the Crest Theater, and thanks to everybody. Thank you.
That was Peter Rossett of Food First, and as you can tell, the negotiations with the police have been going on to assure everybody can leave safely from the Crest Theater.
And Mr. Steve Wirtz, are you at the mic?
We're going back to our
Steve
questions.
Wirtz, please.
This is agriculture, hunger, and biotechnology.
Last question, and then everyone will have a chance to comment on this up and down the line, and then we'll call it a night.
Well, I appreciate being here tonight listening to a debate, and I appreciate having a chance to ask a question. I'm sure there's many more to ask. I've been around long enough, unfortunately, to have heard about the Green Revolution in the 50s and at a time when I was studying malnutrition. And unfortunately, today I come to you, as someone else already said, that there are 25,000 young children under five that die each day in the world from malnutrition and hunger and simple diseases that are solved very simply if we had a better distribution system. The Green Revolution was sold as the modern solution of science solving problems. And unfortunately, it was sold in large part by scientists. I'm a scientist, and I feel my question is, how do we hold scientists and politicians responsible for making unrealistic and undocumented claims for such things that did not pan out the way they were intended?
So, how do we hold scientists and politicians accountable for decisions like biotechnology? We will start down at the end and carry on this way.
Okay, well, it's going to be difficult to conclude on that.
Christian Verschuren of CropLife International.
The results did not pan out the way it was supposed to be. That's not exactly true. I think what we did see in terms of the Green Revolution is in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s, considerable increase in yield and considerable reduction in poverty. And I believe, you know, despite what Anuradha might say, I think including in India. What I think we did see is after that in the 90s, you see a growing population, etc., and we see that no longer the needs are being met. And resolving the complex issue of poverty reduction is a very complex one, and I would agree with that. I think technology is definitely not part of the solution, but trying to address the issue of the distribution systems has failed as well. And what I believe the consensus is, from what I've read and I've talked to several people as well, is that we need to increase the purchasing power, the disposable income of the people, of the rural poor, of the people in the rural community, so that they have a higher disposable income. And that can be done by, among other things, also by increasing yield and technology, and particularly gene technology, can be a solution, a part of that solution, I think, in increasing, the revenues and the status of those people into the rural communities, as it has done, indeed, in the early phases of the rural revolution. And what we need now is a second wave of green revolution in that area.
Let me quickly, for our radio listeners, just rephrase this quickly. The question we're dealing with at the end here is the biotech revolution a replay of the green revolution, and is that a good thing or a bad thing? And how do you hold scientists and politicians responsible for those kinds of big decisions?
By some estimates, the Green Revolution...
David Hegwood, U.S. Department of Agriculture.
If that's a failure, then I don't know how we're going to ever make progress on these issues. Science and technology don't stand still. They continue to evolve. We continue to learn. And we need to learn the lessons of the Green Revolution and the people it didn't help. It passed Africa by. It saved 1 billion lives, but there are still 800 million people that are chronically hungry today. There's more to do. There's always more to do. And we need every tool we can get. Should people be held responsible for that? For making claims like that, I think that's for public opinion to decide. But how do you hold somebody responsible for saving 1 billion lives, but he didn't save the other 800 million?
Thank you very much. Amadou Kanute.
I will answer both as a consumer and as a citizen. As a consumer, I will decide not to buy the product and vote the product out of the market. And then there, I'm punishing the industry, the corporation, and the scientist who put the product on the market, who developed it, who did the research and development and marketed it. As a citizen, I would have the same reaction, the same behavior than with the product. Politicians, they come to us with plans, with programs, and they are elected on that ground. When a politician makes a mistake, and the mistake has far-reaching consequences, the public has to make the decision on whether or not we want to get them out of the market, out of the decision-making position in which we elected them earlier on.
Thank you very much. Sylvia Rivera. Yeah.
I don't think that the biotechnology or genetic engineering is continuing the Green Revolution. In a way, it is completely following the Green Revolution because they are the same companies. It's exactly the same companies. All the companies I mentioned before is the same agrochemical companies that brought us the Green Revolution. And now they're selling transgenics saying that they will use less of their own agrochemicals. It's just to connect this with one thing that was said before. In fact, pharmaceutical, agrochemical, and seeds companies and more of the same the whole time. And they are the same companies that brought us the patent system all over the world through the imposition of the World Trade Organization, through the Uruguay Round, through the TRIPS agreement, the trade-related intellectual property agreements. And they are the same companies, the pharmaceutical companies that then got merged with agrochemical and seed companies. So they are the same companies, they have the same idea, and in that sense, there is a continuation. It's not, I should say that the biotech, or not the biotech, the genetic engineering revolution is very different because the Green Revolution was working with hybrids that could have some kind of regulation through the environment. The transgenics are, so to say, cheating the environment. The nature doesn't know how to handle this. So this is much more hazardous than the Green Revolution. But the companies are the same. It is a continuation in the same way. And in fact, the Green Revolution has not, I don't know how is the criteria about saying that it saved lives, but for sure it has displaced millions and millions of farmers from the lands, and this has caused much more disease and hunger than any technological fix. So I couldn't let the decision to connect with the politicians and science, I couldn't let the decision on any of these aspects in our life to the scientists as they are today. I think that one main thing we have to do is to recuperate the social orientation of science, which is totally, totally apart from society. Science today is working for corporations, 90%.
Thank you very much. We have two left, and then we're going to have to scoot out of here. Martina McLaughlin, please.
Well, I'm neither a politician nor an industrial scientist. I'm a mere academic, and believe me, if you're in academia, it's not for the money. You're there because you love the science and what it can do, and I passionately believe that this technology can be used with other technologies that are specific to local regions to improve the quality of life, the quality of the environment for people in these areas. And I think it is a crime against humanity for any of us to deprive people of whatever means is going to help them to improve their quality of life in a sustainable manner.
Thank you very much. And Anuradha Mittal.
I disagree with some of my colleagues here, but first of all, I want to thank them and say thank you very much for joining us here tonight. Okay, now this is where I disagree. In terms of Green Revolution, at the height of the Green Revolution, food production increased by 17%. But if you remove China from the picture, hunger also increased around the world by 19%. And that's because China went through land reform and other things. So as long as you do not deal with that, any technological fix is not going to solve the problem of hunger. And as Sylvia has pointed out, you see more destruction of livelihoods. And it's not surprising in my country, India, that farmers have been consuming pesticides to take their own lives because we don't have markets. The crops are standing there, and they have huge big debts. And when faced with a dead end, some opt for death. In terms of how to make politicians and scientists responsible, I would agree with Amadou in terms of politicians. Vote them out of office if they do not represent what I believe in. But when it comes to scientists, I would say before we hold them responsible, we have to free them from corporate influence. Our California state universities, as long as state universities, for example, UC Berkeley, getting only 30% of its funding from state, as long as they're financially strapped, the research agendas will be determined by Novartis, by Monsanto, who are funding UC Berkeley. So before we move into the arena of holding them, you know, accountable, we have to ensure that our research budgets, instead of creating a police state, actually go into our education system.
That was on a lot of Midtown of food first, and we are concluding our evening of agriculture, hunger, and biotechnology. A panel discussion and debate that's been taking place here at the Crest Theater. And hang on just one second.
I know it's not been an easy thing to do. I want to first of all ask everyone to give a big round of applause for Mark, our moderator. You are not an easy audience.
Thank you very much. I'll have a quick thank you for our panelists, Anuradha Mittal, Martina McLaughlin, Sylvia Ribeiro, Christian Fershoren, David Hegwood, Amadou Kanute. This has been the debate on agriculture, hunger, and biotechnology from here at the Crest Theater in Sacramento, California on June 23. Thank you all for coming. Travel safely, and good night.
You are tuned to community-supported radio, KVMR-FM in Nevada City. My name is Mike Thornton, joined by KVMR science correspondent Alan Steller. Alan, let me ask you, what are your thoughts about what you heard this evening here?
Well, as you pointed out, Mike, this is historic. And it's at times like this when I feel, well, both frustrated and hopeful that there are so many people interested in these issues, a little bit frustrated in that the issues are so complex that there were good points made on all sides. At the same time, we have to look at, you know, economics has been called the dismal science for a very good reason. You look at the conclusions that an economist comes to when he or she looks at the way the world works. Well, money makes the world go round, and we know who has the money. So, therefore, we know who owns the politicians and who owns the president, for that matter. So it can be very, very frustrating to watch the process, you know, kind of like making sausage is the old cliche. You know, if you ever saw how sausage was made, you'd never eat it again. And if you saw how laws were made, you might think differently about law and order and everything else. I'm not going to go into that any further. I'd like to stick with the science and the technology. I do want to remind folks that there's a real difference. I have friends who I dearly love who are engineers and friends who I dearly love are scientists. And they're very, very different people, and they have very, very different temperaments. At the risk of categorizing people, these are very, very different operations. Essentially, engineering is a trade, and it has always been such. There's a science, at least in general, science is more of an art, if you will. You know, you go very much more on the intuitive in the sciences. And what we're seeing here is very definitely, well, an engineer, and I've taken some engineering courses, the prof tells you, you know, someone comes to you with a problem and they say, solve this problem, and you've got umpteen dollars to do it. you've got a budget, and that's it. So, yeah, there's a perfect way to do it that would benefit everybody, a true win-win-win-win-win situation. I hate the term win-win because it's actually accurate. In a win-win situation, there are two winners, but there's very often a number of losers also. We kind of forget about those folks. Well, you can't have a win-win-win-win solution in engineering generally. You have a certain amount of money and a certain number of techniques, and here's what you've got. It's not a perfect world. And that is definitely what we're looking at. And among other things in this problem that has been handed to the genetic engineers is they've got to figure out a way for the companies they're working for to make a profit. Well, I have nothing against making a profit, certainly not. But at the same time, these people are promising us that they're going to solve the cures, solve the ills of the world. And if they could do that and make a profit, I'd say more power to them. But I'm a little bit hesitant to say that they are indeed going to solve the ills of the world, especially when they promised to solve those ills back with the Green Revolution, and we're coming out of them, and the ills not only don't seem to have improved, yes, indeed, we're feeding more people, but we have more people who are hungry.
And I was going to say that, is that, you know, nevertheless, I mean, we do have a tremendous hunger problem. Not only in so-called developing countries, there's hunger here in the United States. And the thing that I heard is that, you know, the biotech, the scientific attempts at trying to alleviate this massive problem of hunger in the world, there might be some potential there, but there really seems to be a real need for change in politics and political will to explore all of the alternatives to making sure that people have access to decent quality and safe food.
And here we get into the science. It's called by some a soft science, but it's a science nonetheless of social psychology, where we've seen how things can be sold. People can be convinced that smoking cigarettes is sexy. They can be convinced that the war in Iraq was, I forget what that was for. And, you know, there's very sophisticated, very well-trained, and very high-priced experts who really know what they're doing with social psychology and how to sell things. And we see Madison Avenue selling the most bizarre stuff, and yet it does sell. So how do we make clean food, healthy food, sexy? And I think that ultimately is, for me, the only thing. And I've been talking about with friends, you know, just protests and where do we go from here? Does protest in the street work? Is it actually anti-whatever? You know, we've got cheerleaders who you can tune in 6 p.m. on KVMR every weeknight and hear a cheerleader for protesting in the street and all that. I'm not sure myself that that is having a positive effect on the social psychology of the nation.
Well, and certainly that's another subject worth debating.
Yeah, right.
One of the things I think is very clear is that I think more forums like this are needed, where people from diverse backgrounds and diverse viewpoints can actually have an opportunity to discuss them before a public audience. I mean, the theater here at the Crest was full, every seat, standing room only, open to the public, and people had an opportunity to say what they had to say. I have to give a lot of credit, particularly to David Hegwood of the U.S.
Tough
Department
job.
Of Agriculture.
Tough
I
job.
Mean, he had a really, really tough job here tonight. But the fact of the matter was that he came, as well as other proponents of these policies and technologies, and there was a real opportunity to hear, you know, several sides of an issue here.
And a really important point was made in that he was asked, how can you rationalize the policy that the organic farmer has to provide the buffer and the person planting the genetically modified corn does not, when he's the one who's putting the organic farmer at risk? And the representative from USDA could not defend that, and yet that is highly symbolic of how the laws are made and the regulations are made. It's right there. It's not scientific. It's, you know, hey, look what's happening, you know. So I don't want people to get discouraged about this, though, because what I would like to see happen, I think, I might be optimistic, but if we had this kind of thing, you know, there are situation comedies that people watch week after week, month after month, year after year. There are dramas, cop shows, and all that. If we had this happening week after week, month after month, people would become sophisticated, and we would be able to have a reasoned debate, not just debate, a reasoned conversation about this and say, yes, indeed, we will admit, we won't talk past each other. We who are very concerned about biotechnology will admit that these corporations wield an extraordinary amount of power and own an extraordinary number of politicians. And on the other hand, the biotech companies could say, yes, indeed, we got the bucks and we got the control, but if you don't eat the food, we're in trouble. So if we could go on and just have this become part of the culture. Well, that's why I said I really hope this doesn't become just a flash in the pan, that this is something we continue to discuss for as long as we have to discuss it to come to some sort of rational conclusion on it. Have more people eating organic food, and as you know, there's an economy of scale. As more people demand it, it'll get cheaper. It'll be more affordable. So, and then we won't have to breathe the spray that wafts up, that drifts off the fields in Sacramento and is killing frogs in the Sierra. So, I mean, come on, let's get rational about this.
Well, one of the things, and I'd like to begin wrapping this up for this evening, because we've already gone well over the time that we believed that was going to take for this panel discussion and debate this evening here at the Crest. And that's one of the beauties about community radio like KVMR FM, the community radio station that you're listening to right now, is that we had an opportunity, this event, We found out about this event. We found out that we would be able to broadcast it live. People such as Alan Astrom, our crack engineer, who's with us
bravo,
this evening.
Bravo.
And Paul Patterson did everything necessary to make it happen technically. Steve Baker, our program director, who is in the booth, helped to clear KVMR's schedule so we could broadcast this debate. Alan Stoller, our science correspondent. And my name is Mike Thornton, Public Affairs Director at Community Supported Radio, KVMR. We want to thank you for staying with us for what we really believe is a very, very important event here in Sacramento at a very important time. You've been listening to Agriculture, Hunger, and Biotechnology. What role do genetically engineered crops have in developing countries? We heard from a distinguished international panel made up of governmental officials, industry, and academic representatives, and also representatives of international non-governmental organizations tonight.